After a while, I noticed that part of the completely smooth surfaced hull seemed to be turning around. The movement might have involved a third of the hull. And suddenly, the craft shot up in the air, noiselessly, hovering a few seconds at a height of approximately 10 meters. Then, like a lift, it shot upward toward the summits of the Bnina Massif. I had enough time, however, to note that the antenna had retracted and that the upper part of the craft seemed to have a number of portholes or hatches. I managed to shoot another two pictures of the departing disc, and while the distance grew, I felt life coming back to my legs. My voice also returned. I looked at my watch. It was exactly 9:27. Still very confused, and with shaking knees, I went to the rock where my wife was hiding. She had followed everything with her own eyes and was still pale and disconcerted. After a while we went to the landing spot, looking for traces or tracks on the ground, but found none. The snow was absolutely icy. For a while I wondered, however, why the disc, with quite a weight of its own, had left no imprints. But then I remembered that it had hovered at a height of 10 meters, and I realized it could also have done this at 10 centimeters off the ground. Our own shoes left no marks either, by the way. 9. In 1958, my Swiss friend Louise, Lou, Zinstag, a distinguished researcher, sent a letter to the Swiss Military Airfields Administration, enclosing a copy of an article which included one of the Mongutsi photos. She received a reply from the operations unit a few days later. It is with great interest that we read the article. Above all, we are astonished and surprised by the revealing photographic material, especially the picture taken by the Italian engineer Mongutsi in the Bnina Massif, which shows a landed flying machine with a human figure beside it. As we were looking at that photo, we asked ourselves if engineer Mongutsi was able to witness the takeoff of this flying saucer. Do we know whether he might have had the opportunity to locate some other witnesses who observed the machine before it took off? We must strongly emphasize that our question implies no doubt about the genuineness of the object photographed. It arises from a sincere and intense interest in all the questions it raises, and we would be very grateful if you could reply to us. We look forward immensely to your reply and thank you for your trouble. 10. A copy of the original letter in German appears on p. 44. Unfortunately, I do not recall the outcome of this correspondence, but I am sure that Lou sent the administration copies of all 7 photos, together with a copy of the article written for Epica, which would have resolved their questions. Feeling certain of having taken the pictures of the year and planning to sell them at a good price, Mongutsi and his wife went to Milan. The engineer, a member of the Edison Society of Italy, showed them to his friends, to his manager, and to some newspaper reporters. But nobody believed him. All were certain that they were clever fakes. A heated controversy arose in the Edison Society, with the result that Mongutsi lost his membership, and later his job. 11. Would a hoaxer have gone that far? Chapter 4, Eisenhower and the Extraterrestrials. Why don't aliens contact our leaders? My reply to this frequently asked question is that they have done so on a number of occasions, as attested by witnesses. Several such meetings involved President Dwight D. Eich, Eisenhower and others in the mid-1950s, such as at Edwards, Muroc Air Force Base in February 1954, discussed later. There is also lesser-known related evidence supplied by Antonio Ribera, a distinguished Spanish researcher, citing an earlier visit to a base by Eisenhower, at that time U.S. Army Chief of Staff, in Mexico in 1970. The publisher Guillermo Mendizábal Elizalde told Ribera that while attending a gathering during which a title was presented to Miguel Alemán Valdez, President of Mexico, 1946-1952, the subject of flying saucers came up. Alemán listened in silence. But on being asked for his opinion, he revealed that when General Eisenhower had visited Mexico shortly before becoming president, he told Alemán that he had once been taken to an airbase in the southwest United States, where he had been shown a flying disc and the cadavers of several of its crew members. 1. This report was confirmed by Leonard Stringfield, a former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer, who learned from Dr. Robert S. Carr, a University of South Florida professor, that in 1948 General Eisenhower had been taken to see a craft and bodies captured at Aztec, New Mexico in March 1948, and it was on his command that the secrecy lid was clamped down on the subject, and rigidly enforced. Two, since another crash disc had reportedly been recovered that same year just across the Mexican border from Laredo, Texas, it is likely, in my view, that this might have prompted Eisenhower's revelation to Ehrlichman. Until several years ago, I remained unaware of another incident involving Eisenhower and extraterrestrials, reported to have occurred in February 1955. The noted researcher Art Campbell has been responsible for my education regarding what I now regard as compelling new testimony. Campbell served his country during the Korean War at naval shore installations and with a fleet electronics unit aboard the aircraft carrier USS Boxer, CV-21. After leaving the Navy in the mid-1950s, he became active in UFO investigations, working with Major Donald D. Kehoe's National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP. Campbell is the author of an illuminating book on the recovery of a crash disc on the plains of San Agustin, New Mexico, in July 1947, in addition to several books on Northwest pioneer history. More recently, Campbell has uncovered a great deal of evidence that in 1955, President Eisenhower had another meeting with extraterrestrials, which took place at Homan Air Force Base, New Mexico, currently home of the 49th Fighter Wing, Air Combat Command. The following is summarized from Campbell's investigation reports, 3, as well as voluminous additional material which he has kindly furnished me over a lengthy period. Quail hunting. On February 9, 1955, Eisenhower announced to the press that he was going to Georgia for a few days quail hunting, staying with the Secretary of the Treasury, George H. Humphrey, a millionaire industrialist who owned a plantation near Thomasville, Georgia. Others included in the trip were Humphrey's wife, the First Lady and her mother, and Clifford Roberts, a Wall Street banker. The party left Andrews Air Force Base, Maryland, on February 10 at 1300 hours in Eisenhower's Air Force One, Columbine 3, a new Lockheed VC-121E4 and Giant Super Constellation, with a crew of 14, piloted by Major William Bill Draper, who also had been Eisenhower's pilot during World War II. Preceding the flight by about 30 minutes, a chartered plane load of journalists from all the major networks flew to Spence Field, Moultrie, Georgia, some 25 miles north of Thomasville. Columbine 3 landed there 2.5 hours later. With its 2,000 acres of prime bird hunting land, Milestone Plantation suited Eisenhower's requirements for privacy. With the exception of a previously arranged photo op, none of the media was allowed on the grounds. The plantation was so secure, Art told me, that Ike was able to go there 4 times in the 1950s. This was his second trip. The press was housed some 8 miles away at Scott Hotel in Thomasville. James Hagerty, Ike's press secretary, gave daily international news and briefings in the hotel lounge. Many commentators wondered why the president had taken a few days hunting trip at a time when international tensions were mounting. Fear of a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union was paramount, and a very real threat. As the British journalist and historian Sir Max Hastings succinctly puts it, a younger generation finds it hard to believe that it was plausible that America and the Soviet Union would come to nuclear blows. Armies and navies, together with fleets of bombers and batteries of missiles capable of destroying civilization many times over, confronted each other at instant readiness. 4. The hunting party reached the lodgings at Milestone, changed quickly, and reached the hunting area at about 17:30. Media attendees included well-known journalists Ed Darby of Time, John Edwards of ABC, and William Lawrence of the New York Times. Why all the prestigious press for a quail shoot? Perhaps the reason lay in the fact that a week earlier, Joseph Stalin's replacement leader, Georgi Mankov, had been forced to resign and was replaced by Marshal Nikolai Bulganin. A famous military leader taking over an aggressive Cold War government gave the world a severe case of the jitters, Campbell believes. Arthur Godfrey. Campbell questions the presence of Arthur Godfrey on the trip. A famous television personality at the time, Godfrey's shows were watched by millions and helped define the first decade of 1950s television and radio. What was the one and only indomitable Arthur Godfrey doing on the president's plane? Asks Campbell. He was not seated with Ike or his social guests in the main passenger section, but in the forward crew compartment with about a dozen others, including the flight crew and some Secret Service agents. According to news sources years later, including Ted Gupp of Time magazine, Godfrey and Ed Murrow were part of a huge civil defense effort to assist the government in making pre-recorded taped messages to be transmitted on television and radio in the event of a nuclear attack. Campbell continues, Gupp said in his article that a number of newsmen had taken oaths of secrecy and had agreed to accompany the president to the relocation site of his choosing, to lend their familiar names and voices to help calm the surviving audience. Recalling the separate press plane that accompanied Eisenhower to Spence Air Base and Thomasville, one wonders if any of these spokesmen were also along on this strange trip. Was this trip a true potential national emergency, or another trial run of apparently many in those days? There were a number of facilities in the mid-1950s where government could relocate to in the event of a national emergency. One was an underground bunker named Mount Weather, near Godfrey's home in Berryville, Virginia, and another was a facility named Raven Rock, near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where Eisenhower and his cabinet convened on a number of practice occasions. Of incidental interest, Godfrey had flown for the Air Force and Navy in World War II. In 1965 he reported on his own show that he had been buzzed by a UFO while flying a light plane. 5. The Witnesses. On the day following the arrival at Thomasville, James Hagerty reported that Eisenhower had come down with the sniffles and would be staying in for a while. He was not seen again for some 36 hours, having secretly been taken to Spence Field and flown in Air Force One to Homan Air Force Base, New Mexico, together with a team of Secret Service aides and supervisors. One of the many witnesses to the presence of Air Force One was Airman Second Class Manuel W. Kirkland, stationed at Homan and assigned to the base hospital under the flight surgeon, Captain Dr. Robert N. Rayner. Kirkland held clearance to secret material at that time. In late February 1955, relates Kirkland, we heard that the president was coming to Homan. I knew there was going to be an honor parade for him, scheduled for early in the morning. The day before it was due to take place, it was called off. Not only that, but I heard through the grapevine that the base commander, Colonel Frank D. Sharp, had requested leave covering the time the president was visiting. I thought this was unusual. I would have stayed on the base if I was the commanding officer and the president was visiting. Kirkland later realized that going on leave would allow Col. Sharp to give Eisenhower his undivided attention. Later, at the hospital, Dossie E. Moore, the enlisted men's leading airman, asked Kirkland if he had seen a disc hovering over the flight line. Kirkland replied in the negative. I'm thinking, a disc that you can throw, he reports. But the only thing that I knew that hovered was a helicopter and the Navy's hovercraft. He asked what it was made of. Metal, said Dossie, like polished aluminum or stainless steel. How big is it? 20 to 30 feet in diameter. Do you want to see it? Go out to the front of the hospital and look down at the flight line. With my luck it wouldn't be there. I took my wife to the commissary and it was there 30 minutes later. Go out to the front of the hospital and take a look. Concerned at leaving his post without permission, Kirkland asked the head nurse if he could go. She consulted the doctor, but permission was refused. Later, the airman happened to be walking behind two pilots and overheard their conversation regarding the event. One of the men, an officer of the day, was responding to questions from the other pilot relating to Eisenhower's visit. Kirkland asserts that the officer explained that after Air Force One landed, it had turned around and remained on the active runway. The base radar had then been turned off, after which two discs had approached the base at low altitude via the White Sands National Monument. One hovered overhead like it was protecting the other one, explained the officer. The other one landed on the active runway in front of Eisenhower's, plane. He got out of his plane and went toward it. A door opened, and he went inside for 40 or 45 minutes. Asked by the other pilot whether he had seen the aliens, the officer replied that he had not. They stayed inside. Eisenhower then returned to his plane. Later, at about 11:15, Kirkland went to pick up the mail, where he encountered a new second lieutenant supply officer who asked him if he had seen anything on the flight line. Kirkland replied in the negative. After work, about 16:30 to 16:45, I was in my barracks room when I was called out to see Air Force One fly overhead. It flew over the residential area of the base. This is a no-flying zone for all military aircraft. Only the president could get away with it. After supper, Kirkland noticed that the lights were still on in the flight surgeon's office and went over to turn them off. There he saw and heard Dr. Ray Inner talking to a lieutenant colonel, who mentioned that the commander-in-chief, Eisenhower, had addressed 225 men, on two consecutive sessions, in the supply hangar and or the base theater. Eisenhower spoke only for a few minutes on each occasion. Asked by Rayner what had been discussed, the lieutenant colonel replied that the subject matter was classified higher than secret. I share Art Campbell's opinion that since Eisenhower was supposed to be hunting in Georgia, base personnel were ordered not to mention his presence at Hummen. The actual purpose of the visit would obviously never have been disclosed to so many uncleared personnel. 3 months later, while serving in Japan, Kirkland was talking to some airmen, one of whom confirmed that he had heard Eisenhower talk at the base theater. The subject matter was not discussed. Kirkland also said that a mutual acquaintance had learned from a man who had been stationed at Hummen that people were still talking about Eisenhower's visit 2 years later. Captain Joseph W. Kittinger, Jr., retired, who was well acquainted with Kirkland at Hummen, is best known for his daredevil leaps from high-altitude helium balloons as part of research into high-altitude bailout, known as Project Excelsior, culminating in August 1960 when he jumped from Excelsior 3 at 102,800 feet, 31,300 meters, in freefall in his pressure suit for 4.5 minutes. He reached Mach 0.9, almost the speed of sound. He served 3 combat tours in the Vietnam War, during which he commanded the F-4 Phantom 555th Tactical Fighter Squadron and vice-commanded the 432nd Tactical Reconnaissance Wing. He was shot down by a MiG fighter in 1972 and spent 11 months as a prisoner of war in the notorious Hanoi Hilton. 6. What is much less known about Kittinger's background, as I discovered, is his extensive professional contact with Dr. J. Allen Hynek, a scientific consultant on UFOs to both the Air Force's Project Blue Book and the CIA's Office of Scientific Intelligence, OSI. 7. I noted that part of their professional relationship involved, in 1962, Project Stargazer, a balloon-borne project to carry out astronomical studies at high altitude, Kittinger as balloon pilot and Hynek as astronomical advisor. In the Roswell report, case closed, the Air Force's second book attempting to deny the July 1947 incident, Kittinger's sworn testimony states as follows: I worked very closely with Dr. Hynek over a period of 5 years from 1958 to 1963. Dr. Hynek would typically spend a half day working on Stargazer and then the rest of the day participating as one of the consultants on the UFO study, Project Blue Book, that was also conducted at Wright-Patterson AFB. He was very familiar with the techniques and capabilities of the Air Force high-altitude balloon program, and once approached me and we discussed at length the possibility that Air Force high-altitude balloons were responsible for many UFO sightings. I was therefore flabbergasted when Dr. Hynek appeared to believe that some of these sightings were of extraterrestrial origin. 8. During this period at Wright-Patterson, Captain Kittinger also worked at the U.S. Air Force Aerospace Medical Research Laboratory in connection with Project Excelsior, mentioned earlier. In 1959 and 1960, the laboratory collaborated with the Hummen Balloon Branch 4 Excelsior, The culmination of high-altitude freefall studies that began in 1953 using anthropomorphic dummies 9, the same dummies cited in the Roswell report as probably being responsible for the alien bodies reported by witnesses to the Roswell events in 1947. Interestingly, according to June Crane, who worked in the rocketry section lab at Wright-Patterson with top secret clearance at the time, the deceased alien bodies were brought to the AeroMed lab. As it was widely known, they had been flown into the base during the night and were in a freezer locker in one of the hangars, and AeroMed had charge of them for examination, she told investigator James E. Clarkson. The people doing the telling seemed to know what they were talking about. 10. In 2007, Kirkland wrote to Colonel Kittinger, who had been transferred to the Air Force Missile Development Center at Homan in 1954, asking if he recalled the Eisenhower visit, avoiding specifics. "First of all," replied Kittinger, "I remember you and the flight that we made in the Beaver, a bush plane, looking for the downed balloon equipment which we found on the rancher's field. I remember that you were one of the only ones that didn't get airsick. I do not remember President Eisenhower visiting Homan, but it may have been after I left in 1958 when I transferred to the AeroMed lab at Wright-Patterson AFB, Dayton, Ohio." 11. So, no confirmation from Kittinger. We can surmise, however, that, though well aware of the Eisenhower visit, he remains loath to violate his security oaths. Other witnesses, however, have been forthcoming. In 2007, Art Campbell interviewed retired Master Sergeant Robert Bird, one of the former security guards who served on Columbine 3, who said that although the usual complement of Secret Service agents was 5 or 6, if they were flying to somewhere the president had not visited before, 2 agents would go ahead but 5 or 6 were usually on the plane. He learned from Master Sergeant Leo Berger, a colleague and friend, that one trip down to South Georgia had involved a dozen or so going to this tiny little town, Thomasville, and that at about 3 o'clock hours the following day, February 11th, the crew received word that the president would be leaving in about an hour, from Spence Field. "We were always ready for this kind of thing," said Berger, and sure enough, the plane left 1 hour later. He added that about half an hour before the plane left, 2 Air Force cars pulled up and 6 more agents went on board to accompany the flight to somewhere out west. Art found another witness to Eisenhower's arrival at Homan, Albert D. Wyckoff, pseudonym, whose military background included assignment as a tail gunner to a B-29 bomber squadron with the 20th Air Force in the Pacific during World War II. As a staff sergeant on a U.S. Air Force cargo plane that flew into Homan in February 1955, he does not recall the exact date. He and the other crew members watched as Ike's Constellation landed. They had no idea that the president was in it until the following morning. As Wyckoff and the rest of the crew were preparing to leave, an officer approached and told them to stay where they were. "But we have to leave," Wyckoff protested. "Well, President Eisenhower is here and you can't leave the field until he's gone," retorted the officer. Wyckoff and his colleagues were therefore required to kill time at Homan until they had clearance to leave. "Well, in the sergeant's mess at lunchtime," Art recounted to me, "a general invitation was given by an officer to hear the president speak at a nearby hangar. When Wyckoff and several of his crew went there, they were denied entry as they did not have a proper Homan badge. An officer overheard the badge discussion and was able to get them in to hear Ike at another presentation given at the base theater." Campbell also cites testimony he received from a lady whose father, pseudonym Bill Larson, had been a civilian electrician at Homan. Larson and his crew worked from a pickup truck that had a belt telephone bed and many compartments for electrical gear, including a large spool of wire. From time to time, her father had discussed the day Eisenhower came to Homan with his family and others. Here follows part of a letter he sent to his daughter a few months before his death. "Sometime after Christmas 1954 we were told President Eisenhower was coming, so George, our boss, went to a meeting to find out more. He would not be inspecting anything, they said, and we should just carry on as usual. If you see the president, don't gawk, wave or anything, just carry on. So the day the president came, we went out in the truck to a job where we were replacing some wire down the flight line. It was really old stuff, put there in the Second World War. We heard the president's plane in the morning line up for an approach, and watched it land on the far runway. We waited for it to taxi over to the flight line so we could see him. But we didn't hear it anymore, and it had shut down somewhere out there. We went ahead and pulled wire for a while, and one of the men, I believe it was Charlie, said he could see out there from that pole over there, so why doesn't one of us go up the pole and see where the plane is? Well, I had my climbers on and I started to unbuckle them and was waiting to give them to the first volunteer when someone said I should do it, as people were used to seeing me up the poles anyway. So, I started up, with my back to the sun, a safety measure, which also put my back to the runway where I thought his Connie, Constellation, was. As I started up, some of the guys reminded me not to gawk, and I heard them laugh. A few minutes later, I heard someone shouting, and some guy starring the hangar roof nearby started to run, pointing out to the runway. Then I heard our truck start up and some of the crew jumped in, with one or two running after it, and they were pointing out to the flight line, and so I decided to turn around on the pole to see what the ruckus was about, and I could not believe what I saw. There was this python-like thing coming at me about 150 feet away. I thought it was remote-controlled or something, 25 to 30 feet across. And I started down the pole as fast as I could go. I was up about 40 feet, and I threw my climbing rope out, gave it slack and only touched the spike on each side of the pole 3 or 4 times even before I got to the bottom. While I was running toward the big hangar, I looked back and it had stopped, and was just sitting there. Well, when we all got back to the shop, and we had a good laugh, one of the guys that saw me come down said, he got down that pole a whole lot faster than a fireman. Apparently, soon after this incident, the saucer just stopped and hovered about 300 feet over the flight line while the meeting took place on the far runway, near the UFO. Dad said that once the people there got over the initial shock, many just stood and watched it. He said it was a beautiful sight, it had an occasional wobble. He recalled that later that day many neon lights needed replacing. Art Campbell believes this was apparently the saucer that hovered over the flight line, which Dossie Moore and his wife saw around 08:45-09:00. They all thought it was one of our secret aircraft that the president had come to see. Dad said he never considered it was anything but ours until years later when the subject got publicized more, in the 1960s or so. It was only then that he understood what was so secret. Collateral evidence. There is, of course, no official evidence that Air Force One ever left Spence Field, Moultrie, or returned there from anywhere else, during Eisenhower's trip to Hummen, as stated in the official trip narrative, CP 62. Art believes nonetheless that at least one diversionary tactic was employed. For instance, on February 13, the Thomasville Times-Enterprise reported on a special dinner for the president's entourage and numerous other guests, held at the Glenarvan Country Club on the evening of February 11, by invitation of Secretary George Humphrey. About 30 visiting newspapermen, photographers and the movie men were on hand for the delicious dinner, noted the paper. Entertainment included several amusing pantomime selections at the conclusion of the dinner. Art told me that in 2008 he had tracked down a bartender who had been in attendance that evening. He said it seemed that every divorcee in the county had been invited to meet the lonely reporters, 8 to 10 had been invited, but 16 showed up. The pantomime did not go over nearly as well as the Southern Belles in their strapless cocktail dresses. We believe that Ike and Air Force One slipped into Moultrie at about 20:30 while the party was in full swing. This was a trip that no one knew about, and the party that everyone remembered. In May 2010, retiring New Hampshire State Representative Henry W. McElroy, Jr., revealed in a speech that President Eisenhower had been briefed about the presence of extraterrestrial intelligent beings on Earth. McElroy also stated that the document he viewed made reference to the opportunity for Eisenhower to meet the alien visitors. Here follow extracts from the transcript of his speech, When I was in the New Hampshire State Legislature, I served on the State Federal Relations and Veterans Affairs Committee. It was, apparently, important that as a representative of the sovereign people who had elected me to this honorable office, that I be updated on a large number of topics.